This is a production of Cornell University.
I'm calling the meeting to order, and we'll start with roll call. Our Assembly Member is present. Jesse?
Here.
Rebecca? Here. Life Sciences, Tyler?
Here.
Elena?
Here.
Cassandra?
Here.
Physical Sciences and Engineering, Ariana?
Here.
Sarah?
Here.
Alex is sick today. Zenda?
Absent.
Professional Schools, Alexei? Gabrielle? Cheyenne?
Here.
Social Sciences, Margaret?
Here.
Kara Rose?
Here.
Wendy?
Here.
Okay, so with that, we have quorum. And, and now we move on to approval for minutes from our last meeting. Any comments or motions to change anything? Is there dissent to approving the minutes as it is? Seeing none, the meeting, the minutes is approved. And next we have presentation from the Consensual Relationship Policy Committee. We have Dean Van Loon and Anna.
Hi, so some of you might remember that we were up here talking about this last spring about this time, and now we actually have a committee and a draft policy, and those are the details of what we're going to go over now. We are really earnestly looking for feedback on our website. Please leave comments, tell your friends to leave comments, tell your fields to leave comments. This is a contentious issue.
Okay, yeah, so there's great to be back here. It's here last year on the calendar, so I'm wondering what will be the topic next year. So anyway, this is really a very important topic here, and one of the nice things about it, from my point of view, was just having Anna as co-chair and having a committee that's very symmetric in terms of faculty, grad students, and the other constituencies. The policy is actually not that long. It's about 5 pages. Everyone is extremely busy these days. So there's actually a one pager there that sums things up. And the slides you're seeing here, of course, is another form of outline. And these we're going to use to fill at the UA tomorrow night and at the Senate on Wednesday. Okay, so we've done a lot of homework, okay? So, and met with lots of groups and people. The committee itself has met a lot. We put 10 sort of study questions up there back in December, and we've got some good comments. Unlike the calendar, where we literally got thousands of comments, we've gotten dozens here, but they're very, very thoughtful, and people have spent you can tell when you read them, a lot of time in putting together those paragraphs. We've looked at the comparable policies at 50 other schools. There's a lot to learn there. Locally, we, of course, talking to all the assemblies, but we've met with all the college HR people because they see things a certain way. We've met with 20 of the graduate field assistants because they, too, have a certain perspective on this. We're not done. As Anna said, we need feedback. We're entering a sort of a one-month public comment period on the pros that we have out there. The idea is that all these assemblies, and the Senate included, will then, in April, vote on the policy. That vote, together with comments, I mean, maybe, you know, in a few weeks you'll get together and decide whether you want to vote for or against this policy. But there'll be discussion. You know, maybe you like everything except this paragraph. Well, we're assuming each assembly will, produce the vote outcome, but also comments, because what goes to Martha, who charged this committee, is going to be the union of those votes and comments. Okay?
in all of this, we are still going around to groups. We've been, for example, to the Women's Resource Center. We're going to hear from some LGBTQ plus groups. If there are specific groups that you think we should hear from or go meet with, please email either one of us, and we would be happy to set that up in the time that we have left for comment periods. That has been very useful, actually, to us as we've shaped this. And you're also welcome to come to various more meetings.
Okay, so this is a controversial issue. It gets to matters of personal choice, and part of the homework, and I started doing this last summer, is trying to understand the complexities of this. So here's a book that sort of makes it a strong case for the right to romance and ties it into the Ninth Amendment, okay? So it's really important to understand all these perspectives, and I mentioned this. This maybe applies more than the Senate. People, about 2 years ago, were kind of afraid to say, you know, I'm against the undergraduate ban or something like that. People shouldn't be afraid. They're well-reasoned, defendable opposition points, and we want to make sure that people aren't shy about speaking up against some of the things that we may propose. Another point of view is what I would sort of say some people feel is Title IX overload here, and a view that people have the right to make mistakes, okay, and so on. So it's very important to be not only respectful, but to try to understand all these different points of view. We come at it in many different ways. And like anything, you know, we want to have a really healthy, open discussion across campus. Okay, so that's what I'm sort of saying here. You know, we're particularly interested in people who don't like this or that passage in the Con Pro. So understand your point of view, and it's not cast in concrete. As I said, we have 4 weeks here. Things may change. So it's not like a fait accompli by any means. Okay, so the question is, what is this? Who are the players here? So there are many possible pairings out there when you talk about relationships. We're always interested in when what we call the subordinate is a student or a postdoc. Okay, so this is not about faculty, staff, you know. It's always the case, and every time you talk about a relationship, that there's a student in there, a student or
a postdoc or veterinary resident.
Right.
Two weird exceptions because they function somewhat akin to how students do in this environment. I'm dwelling on them here a little because we don't have a great forum for hearing from them, and sometimes they get bumped in with grads and professional students.
But virtually anybody can be a what we call the authority in this. And we split the population up into these five groups. The faculty include tenure track, non-tenure track, research professors, lecturers, and so on. And it is possible for an undergrad to be an authority, you know, you're an undergrad grader in a big course, and there's a student, also an undergrad, in that course. Okay, so here's the two classes of what we call prohibited relationships, and this is one that involves undergraduates, and we're recommending that no consensual relationship exists between a faculty member and an undergraduate.
So this is actually less something that the whole committee came up with than something that the undergraduate part of the committee studied at length and slowly came to this unanimous conclusion by the end of last semester. It's not about age. It's about making sure that their academic trajectory is not restricted by current or previous relationships. Any person, any study, but part of that for undergrads is possible breadth of experience and perhaps changing majors in a way that doesn't really apply to us.
As I said, we looked at policies at many different schools. In that group of 50, 17 of them have this. If you look at the Ivy Leagues, most do. The Latin, you know, I like our stance on this. It's not that undergraduates are too young or undergraduates are immature. It's driven by a principle that we have here, which is this: any person, any study, you deserve the clear access to any course on campus without any kind of interference in this direction. But this is a controversial point. The other class of prohibitions have to do with direct authority. Okay.
Some of what we're thinking of here is ethical implications and reputational implications. Our degrees are worth less if people think we can achieve them by trading sex for letters of rec, which does happen. Our degrees are compromised if perhaps there is favoritism in labs. Our access to opportunities, and that applies even if you're not the one in the relationship. But if someone in your program, lab, research group is being singled out for special treatment, or it looks like they are, that causes issues. So how do we avoid those conflicts of interest? What conflicts of interest are just too much to deal with while maintaining academic integrity?
So that is, I'm sure we'll come back to this, which is a possible version. We could have, for example, thought about a ban between faculty and grad student if they're in the same field. We're not doing that, okay? But I think that's a real important thing to talk about.
You should weigh in on that.
Okay, again, postgraduates, you know, you might have a faculty supervisor, there'll be maybe a department chair or a center a director in the background. That's an example of direct control. Undergrad, okay, so again, undergrad faculty is prohibited, but they're coaches, all right, they're grad TAs, all right, and so on. So you're an undergraduate in the course, and here's a grad TA running your section, for example. So here are some of the pairings and things that one would have to be careful with when an undergraduate is the subordinate.
So what this would mean is sort of checking ahead of time if you're TAing for a large group. Professor would check in. Are there any conflicts of interest? You disclose. You're probably not grading that particular person's work. If you're something more like a writing instructor, then you probably get to wait until the semester is over if you want to pursue a romantic or sexual relationship with one of your students.
So in the policy is what could be called sort of disclosure recusal mechanisms. And just as a side note, but again, words are incredibly important, but we don't use these words shallowly. Most other policies out there at other universities, we talk about management plan. Okay? So managing, you know, that has a certain connotation. Faculty don't like it. You're managing me in a way I don't like. But it's about recusal. Here's a setting that I think a lot of you can relate to. Okay. So for example, student, faculty member, same field. Okay? That's not necessarily something you want to prohibit. Say there's quite a distance here. That topic area is very different from this topic area. However, we all know that grad fields on occasion get together and talk about students, support, your academic progress, okay? In that setting, the faculty member here should recuse his or herself from that kind of a setting. So recusal simply, it's like, you know, I think of it as I'm going to leave the room, all right, when this person's being discussed, okay? And a couple of things, you know, you can look at this picture and say, oh, this is an intrusion. But you can also look at this picture and say, I have respect for my colleagues and for how we run our field. Okay? So you can look at these things in different sorts of ways. Okay, and so one of the boxes, so you see the DGS. Who do you recuse, who do you disclose this relationship to? Clearly the DGS is going to have to know because the DGS will probably run these kinds of meetings, will be involved in those kinds of decisions. But one of the things we have to have, and we reach this conclusion because so many times when you read the paper, stuff gets swept under the rug. You have to get things out of departments, out of fields, okay? You know, if this is Professor Big, okay, the tendency for that to happen goes up. So in all our disclosure, when you see the enforcement things, there has to be an outside, impartial entity. We're calling this the 6.X office. It's kind of a placeholder, although we have definite ideas about where it should be and how it should interact. But that disclosure has to go to that person. Okay, it could be directly. Maybe I'm a little, maybe my relationship with the DGS is a little funny, and I'm more comfortable going to that other box. We want to have options in all these settings. This is a very tricky, delicate issue. We have to respect that people have different feelings towards it. So different avenues. So some way or another, that office is going to get involved there. The other thing here is, let's not think about the recusal plan as a 10-pager. It's probably two sentences here, right? That, hey, we have annual meetings where we talk about TA shifts and progress and whatever. It's not a very big deal to construct a recusal plan, okay? We'll have guidelines about that, but it's not some additional heavy bureaucratic red tape, okay?
And then in all of this, something that GPSA specifically asked for last year is in the current draft, where the office or some program, but probably the office, will check in with the subordinate, not intrusively, voyeuristically, like, how's your relationship going? Just, we've had a disclosure, here are resources if you need them, here's our contact info if you want it. And that's hopefully going to help bring stuff in the open and make sure that if things do go sour, people have access to this resource, because we know that when things shade into bad relationships or lack of consent, which is not what this policy deals with, but when they shift over into that, we know there's an issue on campus where people don't always know what resources are available.
This diagram can be, we can relabel all the boxes. Here's another setting you might be familiar with. Big course, you're a TA. Hey, undergrad setting the course, I'm going to tell the faculty person in August about that. And the recusal plan will have something to do about, I'll be in some separate, I'll run a separate section, or when we get together and grade exams or give final grades, there'll be another, very natural way of recusing you from the grading of this student. So I just, there are a couple of versions of this diagram, and it's kind of an easy matter just to relabel those points. Enforcement. Okay, this is very important. The failures from 2 years ago just had a placeholder, the recusing, what was the term, some term that just turned everybody off. We owe the community some details here, okay? And I'm showing you the essentials of those details, okay? And so you can follow these boxes. Remember, this is not about harassment. The way you violate this policy is, A, you have you're engaged in a prohibited relationship, or B, you fail to disclose and didn't live up to the recusal pattern, for example. Those are the only things here that are violations. Okay, so you have it, if something comes in the door, and you first have to investigate whether or not it has merit. In all these boxes, their decisions, and the disclosure office, my office, and the department chair or DGS will be involved in all these decisions. So that it's not like one person deciding everything. Everybody knows, not in the 1984 sense, that everyone's watching, okay? So
that sounds bad.
So you decide, if it has merit. Okay, so, was it about a prohibited relationship? Well, if that's the case, that's pretty serious. And that then becomes something that is forwarded to the dean. Again, these decisions are by what we call the group, okay? If it did not involve a prohibited relationship, then we're talking about a disclosure scene. And it may or may not be resolvable locally. If someone was harmed, or if there was something bad that happened, then again, that has to go up. That has to go to the dean and with possible sanctions and so on. But it might be locally resolvable, okay? Oh, I forgot to sign, you know, I forgot, you know, you can imagine things that are low-key, no harm, solve it locally. A problem that you don't want to have in this thing is that everything immediately is DEFCON 3 and goes to the dean. You have to have provision for intermediate solutions. We're all busy, and that includes deans. We have to be careful about this. Try to solve problems locally. Okay, so, and you can, this isn't labeled here. I've sort of maybe talked my way through as if it's faculty, grad student. But again, a version of this could exist for other parents. And brilliant flowchart. Okay. All right, so let me sum up. Okay, let's sum up here. With this. So again, 6.x is our placeholder name for this policy, and it's going to be in the university policy library. Okay, right now, it's these three little paragraphs buried in the faculty handbook.
Which turns out it applies to us. Who knew that? But not me.
We have the same with faculty.
So anyway, so it's going to be elevated. Not that this solves all problems, not that the library is a brilliant show, you know, collection of policies, but it's going to be given the highest status. Getting back to the end game, all the assemblies and Senate will send this stuff to Martha. Hopefully, there's some agreement about this. Let's say there is some agreement or whatever. Then the lawyers will get together, take our stuff, and shape it into the format of a policy. So think a little more about the end game. It's all over the place. If these five recommendations and votes are all over the place, it's not going to be a happy scene. Here's why. The lawyers are still going to write the thing. But now when it comes down, people are going to say, oh, it's this, the fourth floor day hall cooking up some policy. So it's in our interest to think out loud across all these assemblies so that when we show up on May 1st on Martha's desk, the policy, the campus has spoken, okay? There'll be disagreement, but we've spoken. Okay? Anyway, just continue. So the high points again are prohibition on undergrad faculty things, exercising care with direct control and being a little more refined when graduate students are involved. And a recusal mechanism there that's low overhead and gets people to think that, yeah, this relationship affects more than just these two people, all right? 99% of all this is just thinking about this stuff and educating ourselves. We haven't been able to sort of talk about this stuff in a healthy way until now. Okay.
Part of what we're doing outside the policy is laying groundwork for having these discussions with faculty in their fields, for having these discussions with grad professional students in their fields, so that really this is prevention.
Yeah, I mean, it really, 6.x, consensual relations. In my head, it's 6.x, harassment prevention. Okay, harassment prevention. Okay, and again, about this office, there are lots of details there. You know, cost is an issue. But the key thing here is that you need some entity out there that transcends all the fields and the departments, okay, who would then work with all the usual players and these sorts of things. Okay, that's it, and we now really want to hear from you.
So if you have questions or comments, you can raise your placard or hand. I'll start the speakers list. Okay, I have Matt, Vera, and Jesse.
First of all, thank you very much. I appreciate the invitation for ATL. I also appreciate the amount of time and effort to put into it. I guess I have two questions and points to make. So I'll start with the easy one. In terms of, for the list of prohibited relationships, it mentions for graduate professional students that anyone who holds an administrative position in a subordinate department, school, college at all is prohibited. And my question is this way, how broad is that? Because thinking back to law school, practically every faculty member I have is the director or dean of something, or associate vice dean of something. So in terms of, clearly, if you're the associate vice dean of alumni affairs, and there's nuance there, I'm just curious how you plan to control or account for that, because clearly I can see where there would be concerns and where there wouldn't be.
So in other words, I mean, I grew up in a setting where you have a chair and an EGS period, so it's kind of simple. So we need, in other words, when we say administrator in your unit or field or department, we need to specify a little more what that is. And it gets into a direct control sort of thing. So for example, the TGS, I think, is an obvious sort of thing, but if the administrator runs some far-off corner, budget thing, so greater clarity on that is a good point.
Thank you. And the next thing on this was in terms of, I often actually, I remember original early draft, it said, oh, we're in panels, we're always within your department, and I heard from a number of professional students that was pretty problematic because the professional school is so large. In terms of, this actually touches on, I heard from a couple of non-traditional students who may be doing dual programs, such as the BS JD or the BS MBA, where they ask people are straddling the line. It pulls out non-traditional students about concern against prohibitions, this blanket against undergrads. And the faculty, and the reason I bring this up, and I'll happen to bring some other forms, is that grad professional students have, like, was that I heard people say it to them, well, it sounded like in local parentheses, the same idea that this university has thousands of classes, dozens of colleges. I mean, I understand the concerns you raise, but the concerns you raise would even apply to me. I, as a professional student, I take classes in five departments. I've actually thousands, I mean, hundreds, if not over a couple thousand classes. And the concern was for non-professional students, where the students can be, they're not traditional undergrad, or they are so completely apart that you don't see a blank ban ignores the nuance and the diversity of our community. It's something to bring forward.
Okay, so,
I mean, you can take classes in five departments. I can theoretically take classes and then snuck into the hotel school. But I don't need to for my program. I was admitted for medieval studies. Everyone in this room who is a graduate professional student was admitted for a focused field. We should probably consider looking at the, you were saying BS, MBA,
yeah,
and
BS
and number,
yes,
as to whether they count as undergrads or professional students for this policy. That's a point we'll have to revisit. As for the non-traditional aspects where it's just about age, we have not based this policy on age. If you're above the age of consent, that's all that matters. We have a binary here legally, and it seems, in fact, paternalistic to impose anything beyond that, which I know that a number of our peer institutions do. But what you're proposing is redefining, in short, sorts of undergraduate study, where some are already focused and some aren't, and that does not appear to be something Cornell as a whole is on board with, unless we're changing our notions of education.
Your question is good, and it's one of the two or three hard ones, which is what's the difference between an undergraduate and a graduate student? So, yes, we don't talk about chronological age, but if you have an undergraduate degree, that means you have an undergraduate experience. There is, and that counts. Okay, every graduate student, in our definition, has an undergraduate degree. With that comes experience. So there's some practical, and maybe two other practical reasons why that gets at this. So when we were at the SA, Anna and I looked around that table. There were 25 students. These cases, when they get in the course, are millions of dollars, okay? How would you like to visit every one of those parents who are paying for that tuition to say, thank you for your $60,000, but we're using it for lawyers to get us to resolve this particular case, and it's much more intense when an undergraduate is involved. Another example, so I know law students pay for tuitions, but another example, which has to do with perhaps a recusal mechanism. So I'm an undergraduate, I've had a relationship with a person that I now have to take, that's gone bad. I'm a senior, I gotta take this course, and it has, let's say, 300 students in it. It's my senior year, I can't sit there because I had a bad relationship with that professor. Okay, so now what do we do? Are you in a grant setting?
In a consortium, like the Five College Consortium, we could have deals with other schools where that answered that problem, and you just take the course somewhere else. If we were in New York City, maybe. We're not.
to solve those kinds of problems in the undergraduate population are really much more difficult than the grad population. So there are practical reasons in this as well. So.
Thank you, Rachel. I have one quick point which I'll make because I don't want to take too much time from my colleagues. I mean, I had 2 points and a question, and they were just sort of back. You know, we'll talk after. You're coming to me tomorrow, we'll talk after.
Okay. So, Dara, I have Dara, Jesse, Cheyenne, and then.
I just want to thank you guys for an amazing presentation and for all your work so far. I think you've covered a lot of ground in a short period of time, and it's pretty remarkable. I was just wondering how exactly, because I know we first gathered as a round table the question of how we make the disclosure mechanism compelling to faculty, for example. How have you framed the mechanism to become effective and as appealing as possible? Who's the burden placed on, and how do you ensure that faculty would implement it?
Burden of disclosure is on the authority, which, again, everyone in this room, if you're a grad or professional student, you might be the authority if you're teaching. And it is never on the subordinate. And we're trying to make sure that where there are processes, if things go wrong, to fix the situation, that in as much as possible, the subordinate's academic trajectory is not affected.
How did it work?
To encourage disclosure rather than hiding it. Trying to make penalties, such as they are, less severe or in fact not there if you're disclosing, even if it's belated, as opposed to if someone reports like, hey, my faculty advisor is in this relationship in our lab and it's really messing everything up.
Yeah, so in a lot of these things, there's a little dial return. So if you come out with really hard ass, no one's going to disclose, and a lot of stuff is driven on the ground. If you make it too easy, then it's pointless. So you try to hit it right there at the right point. So it should be a teaching moment. Right? That sounds corny, but the fact is, we want faculty to think that you have this relationship has an impact that's beyond you and that other person. And you owe it to the field, if you go back to the example we use, to make sure that the way we make decisions is free of bias. Okay, as simple as that. I can tie your question, which is very good, to something that Matt brought up. Let's talk about disclosure. And in your own head, do the arithmetic. Who's more likely to disclose? A professor who is having a relationship with a grad student or an undergrad? So the fact is, I think, you know, if you allow if you have some wiggle room there about undergraduate relationships, you know, just from a practical point of view, I don't think you're going to get a heck of a lot of disclosures.
And then just one last note is that often that's a matter of academic integrity. Like, grads, at least the faculty in our field get together and discuss us. If you didn't know this, you should. And if you're in a relationship with one of those faculty members and they haven't disclosed, they can be in there talking you up in a way that you haven't necessarily earned academically. And where we find that, we're hoping to sort of pursue it as a breach of academic integrity, because we already have processes for handling it when you have violated your own academic integrity by cheating or something. This will be as if they had violated their own, except that actually it's yours. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Jesse?
More thank yous, et cetera, thank you. I personally like a lot of the rules that you guys have, or policy points that you guys have put up. I'm in a field of setting your funding is determined by a small group of faculty, and it would be really nice if there was a recruitment process in that discussion. My question is actually this limitation of spell out really explicitly what do you need most from us? Do you want to either just have a bunch of us like individual comments, or are you looking for like a formal thing from the GPSA saying, this is what we think of the policy as a whole, except for the paragraph, so and so?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Individual comments are great, but we do also want some formal feedback from the GPSA, and especially where it is relevant to graduate and professional students. So should faculty in your field be entirely off limits? That's something that you could come back and tell us, and we would seriously look at incorporating into the final version we sent. Professional students, are we missing something with you all? Please, this is the space to get like the weight of a whole assembly behind the suggestion.
Yeah, clearly there are major things, like Anna pointed out, that you strongly feel as a group that faculty, that within field relationships are off limits, that is something that the group can really weigh in on, but then also individual. I mean, it's going to be up to how you, what you staple to your voting results. And
I think someone proposed in a letter to the Sun that no grad should have a relationship with other grads. If that's something you want, you should tell us.
Okay. I have Eugene next.
Yeah, I guess we've explored a little bit the extent of what academic authority means, but I also noticed that it has something about professional advancement authority, and I was wondering how far that goes. Just as an anecdote, my wife works in central HR for the university, and she has access to all of my human resources records and job information and things. And like, would that be the sort of thing that's covered by this, and how far does that kind of thing go as well?
So you're saying that she should recuse herself from looking at your records. Is that what?
Well, yeah, I'm wondering if even this type of thing that is
a good point. But I would sort of say if she participated in a decision that had to do with your benefits or salary or something like that, then sure, recusal. But then looking at, no one's saying in that diagram that the professor doesn't have access to the test scores for everybody in the who took the qualifying exam in the field. It's a question of what do you do with that information? Do you have the power to affect your professional or academic future?
And some of it's going to be just exercising, like, reasonable sense. Is it likely that your wife is going to have to weigh in on you in a professional capacity? Then she should probably give someone a heads up. If it's not really likely, then if it comes up, she should mention it, but...
Yeah, that's just one example. I'm just sort of like testing like what the boundaries of all this are and like how broad or how specific it is.
Yeah. Everything is in this arena is fuzzy. What is a relationship? You can go down the list of every term we mentioned and you can spend an hour to talk about it. Again, I think what we're counting on is just prevention and just people being more sensitive to this issue.
Next, we have Cheyenne.
Hi, thank you, Bro. You mentioned this just a little bit ago, and I somehow missed it. Did you say that veterinary residents are considered to be faculty members?
We are playing fast and loose with terminology and counting veterinary residents and postdocs as students for the purposes of this policy, in that the policy only applies to relationships where one member is a student.
Okay, and are you differentiating, this is a field-specific question, obviously, but important for bringing back to the festival, are you discriminating between veterinary interns and veterinary residents? Because I noticed that only interns are mentioned in the terminology portion, and they're very different.
Can you tell us what we should be doing, and perhaps ask the other vet students? We don't have a vet student on the committee. Thank you.
There was actually a posting this weekend on that. So it's a fuzzy area. It's not that I use students as a metaphor there on that slide, but really, who can we put in the subordinate slot is what we're talking about.
Okay. Ethan?
Yeah, I have a question about the, essentially, some of the disclosure mechanisms. You were mentioning, Charlie, that you your diagram, you can sort of relabel things in different situations. Right, so if a graduate student is in a relationship with a faculty member, then maybe the DGS is the right person to talk to. If there's two undergraduates in a relationship and one of them's grading for a big course, then it would probably be the course instructor.
Yeah.
What sort of the enforcement mechanism at that lower level when you don't have the 6.x office involved, and how public is this disclosure expected to be?
Well, I would say, part of it, again, is education. So we will come out with, and I send out, you know, starter term messages to all the faculty. For example, you're going to have this meeting in August where you're meeting all your TAs. You know about this policy. We're thinking about having a little checkbox on all the, some of the what's the form, the SR, what's
Student Progress Report.
Yeah, a little checkbox. You know, I have read and understand this policy. This is positive to be in people's face so that you're just aware of this stuff. So, yeah, sorry, so maybe I'm the grad student. Do I or do I not tell the professor that I'm going out with this the undergrad in the course? The professor will take the initiative. You know, hey, you can either see me in my office, just tell me, and we'll just very quietly solve this problem. But on the other hand, sometimes things are going to be known. So, for example, when I get up and leave the room, when we're talking about TA, you know, TA assignments, people are going to, you know, people are going to have to know about that. But it's not something, you know, it wasn't to embarrass people. It's just to inspire ethical behavior. But I would say the vast majority of people subscribe to it.
We are building in some redundancies because I'm sure people can think of situations where they might not want to disclose to their DGS or to their chair. And we want to make sure that, nonetheless, there are avenues. The goal is to keep information as private as possible, especially understanding that some people don't want their relationships to be public. That said, part of a recusal plan in certain situations may be like telling other people in the lab. That is done for financial conflicts of interest, and that's something that we're modeling a lot of this off of. It's going to wind up being largely case by case.
I have you. I just have one question. So the policies that are prohibited, what do you do with big existing relationships? Non-traditional
grandfather clause.
It's tricky. I mean, so suppose you have this situation, grad student, undergrad, we hire this person to be a professor, they can work like this, okay? So would it be fair for Cornell, people who've been here their whole time, would that be fair to grant an exception? So I talked both to the head lawyer and also the office that deals with the dual careers and stuff. This is such a small, the number of cases here is minuscule. Every single policy out there has, Cornell, you always find a way to solve something with common sense. I mean, so you look at tenure rules or whatever, stuff comes up, you can't cover everything in a policy. You want the policy to address 99% of the situations. So, I'm not personally nervous about those kinds of things coming up or not being able to handle them.
Okay, so we have run out of time. So if you have more questions, you can visit the website, right? And they have comments. Thank you so much. Thank you. So next on the agenda is division breakups.
Okay, so sort of all the same thing. Jesse, do you guys want to go to Bear, or where do you want them to come to you, or wait? Okay, so Dan is not here today, so for physical sciences, you are Ariana, are you going to take
yep.
it?
Yep.
You okay?
Yep.
Ariana's going to take physical sciences. Never mind. So they're back there. Humanities, they're life sciences, social sciences, and professional schools. With me.
Yeah, my question is going to be the code. This is the code theory problem. Sorry.
I'm going to go to the next one.
we can have a chat. One of which I'm right on top of the
floor. When you say we want to have
the field rep. So when the field rep, that was what each division sort of reported back, was like, we like want to have one of the side. So we started thinking, okay, well, what would happen if we wanted to get one? And one of the first things that came up was like, if we going to be back to the problem of having the side, it was right now it's already two.
You also have a lot of them that are kind of, oh, hey, I would say that a lot is the best one of our other professions. My field reps are not allowed. I solicited volunteers, and I think that the GPSA is so far removed from the professional school. Would be to establish that sort of committee-based voting status would further the problem unless the GPSA made an attempt to sort of better integrate.
Are you talking about internal voting? There's a lot of
I think that would be helpful because right now, I learned about GPSA for me and through my desire to connect with a wider universe. Like, that was completely self-motivated.
Yeah.
Most of it, I would argue that professional students feel so sort of alienated from the wider graduate school community that, like, something like that would absolutely, at least, have to be necessary.
You don't have to wait to change field rep voting status to create more additional voting members to do and add to the like that doesn't have to be with like a complete restructuring of the GPSA.
Okay,
we can do that. Yeah, we can do that like right now as like a professional as an increasing professional team representation on the GPSA initiative, not just like a generic restructuring. No one has ever said, like, for fields that are, like, massive, like, the professors, you can't have more field reps, because most of us, we need as much professional reps. Like, one of those roles that we don't really have before.
It's already so grad heavy that I'm a law school member. But see, you don't understand. It's so heavily focused on grad students, you don't get the interest in grad students. So to me, it's first thing you do is make sure you go through the process. Hope this happens, and you have to take the hope your hand and say, okay, hey, yes, we're only 40%.
And the next item on the agenda is comedy updates. Can we start with the deck?
I can talk really loudly other people, but it's fine. Exact update. Rena sent an email to the general body about a voter registration drive. We're partnering with Indivisible on campus to help get students registered to vote. If anyone's interested in that or would like to help actually man that event, please let us know. I don't think Bree and Nick are here, so I'll just do it in my update. We had a meeting, Rena and I had a meeting with Catherine Thresher Carroll from Cornell Health about doing notice and respond training for TAs. So right now, with programs that have mandatory TA training, get notice and respond training, which is essentially intervention if you think you have a student that might be suffering from depression or anxiety, and intervening so that they can get help. We're going to be doing workshops so that any TA who would like to opt in and receive that training can receive that training. And that's it for exec. Yeah. Operations. I'm giving Alice's update, so more from me. The next formal OSC meeting will be the week of the 19th, and we're going to continue having this conversation about restructuring, and if anyone's interested, please reach out to Alice so that we can make sure that we find me and we need to get all the information, I guess. Cool.
Communications?
No, it's
appropriations.
No, okay.
Finance.
No.
Student advocacy, they're not here today. Does anyone want to speak up for that? Jesse, you're in the...
Yeah, with new stuff. So we're trying to follow up on things that happened that were brought up as issues at the town hall. So things like bus passes for student employees, things like making sure during snowy seasons that handicapped parking spaces are clear. Also, accommodations for, especially law school, right? Especially law school accommodations for students who work through the disability office. So a whole bunch of things in motion that we're trying to get folks who come to staff meetings to talk to us about as a group, so that way they don't have the same people that can be meeting with them. So.
Okay.
And also, SAC, I'll be creating a Slack channel on the GPSA workspace that will give regular SAC updates, and that will be sometime in the next couple of days. So
okay. Cool. Disc?
Yeah, to follow up on Disc and SAC, co-host at the town hall, so we're working on sort of the same stuff at the same time. Just to add an additional bit of information about the law school, the issue there is accommodations work differently in the law school than they do in other parts of campus, so we're probably going to be trying to schedule a informational session for law students so that student disability services can explain how their procedure works quite differently than what students might have been used to at like their undergrads, because it's just a different system. But just specifically, in addition to also working on some of those things, another thing that was brought up at the town hall was English proficiency of international students. And I met with Jan Allen last week, and we have a plan going forward to work with the committee in the grad school that does that kind of thing. Just update some language on the website to let people know that things like waivers for the TOEFL are available. You just need to contact the DGS of the program you're applying to, and stuff like that. We're also going to specifically is going to be meeting with a variety of administrators in the professional schools, grad school, and all the resource centers on campus. This is something we do about once a semester, and so that's going to be March 28th. And if anyone's interested in coming and meeting with those folks, let me know. What's the other thing? So every month we try to do some sort of lunch dialogue, as we call it. And this month will likely be on March 20th from 11:30 to 1 o'clock. The room is still not been scheduled. And we're going to be talking about mental health for graduate professional students. That will be sort of the topic of discussion for this month. I'll send out updates to the GPSA listserv once the details have been finalized.
Okay. Programming?
Hi everyone. So I no longer have any funds left for co-sponsorship, and also if anybody has emailed me this week, I will get back to you. It's finals week number 4, so that's cool. Also, a lot of this got back to me. They will be catering for grad school, so again, that's going to be on May 5th at the Museum of the Earth. It's going to be $20 per ticket, and you'll hear more about theme, et cetera, as we get closer. So, thank you.
Do we have faculty awards? Mm-hmm. Okay, so general comedy.
No, please.
Okay, and we have the consensual relationship.
presentation. So grad school. Now we can move on to your business of the day. We have introduction to Resolution 12, calling for the creation of RED, a professional student-specific notice and respond friend-to-friend workshops. So we have Minisha.
So as I sort of hinted at during my the exec committee update, Rena and I actually met with Catherine Thresher Carroll at Cornell Health, who runs a lot of these bystander intervention training programs. And while we were talking to her about notice and respond, she mentioned to us that Cornell Health has created some of these bystander intervention training programs specific to intervening in cases of mental health. And the two that they've created are the essentially for undergrad to undergrad intervention training, which is the notice and respond friend-to-friend workshop. And there's also the notice and respond faculty to student workshop. So those, when I'm talking, when we were talking about the TA training workshops, that's the faculty to student. But in addition to that, they had this friend-to-friend one for undergrad. And during our conversation, she sort of mentioned that they had been really hoping to create a graduate and professional student specific version of that program, particularly because graduate and professional students, not only do we also suffer from mental health problems but just get lumped in with the undergrads, we have a really unique set of circumstances where we're kind of both straddling this line between professional and personal. We're friends with a lot of people who are also our professional colleagues, and that changes how our intervention tactics may work. So when we were talking to her about this, she mentioned that while she and the people that she worked with really want this, it sort of stalled. They reached out to the Alumni Affairs Office to try and solicit funding. She estimated that it would cost anywhere from $50,000 to $80,000 to develop these programs, and they've been trying to find funds for it, and it just hasn't gone anywhere, and that sort of stalled. So this resolution is really a call to the administration and Alumni Affairs Office to find the funds for these workshop programs, because it's really important. That's sort of all I have. I'll take questions. Questions? Dara?
Is this something that the coalition is going to maybe cover as well as maybe
So, yeah, I'm not sure. So I'm now on the coalition.
So Manisha is in.
Yeah, I'm on the coalition. I'm going to bring it up, but I don't know whether or not they're actually going to give funds for it or not. They might discuss it, but I haven't gotten secure.
Probably bring it up there.
Thank you. Any other comments? Questions?
Cool. So because the coalition is meeting tomorrow, I actually think it's prudent not to pass this resolution and for me to come back with updates next time.
Motion to table resolution.
Seconded.
Any dissent? Seeing none, the resolution is tabled. And we have two other resolutions that we have tabled previously. First one, resolution 9. In support of,
so you actually don't need to necessarily pull it up. So unfortunately, Elena, myself, Joe, who's the co-sponsor on the resolution, and myself were supposed to meet with Vice President for Campus and Student Life, Brian Lombardi, Dean of Students, Vijay Kandikor, Aiden Coffey, who's the interim director of the RC, and Angela Winfield and Cornell Woodson from HR to actually talk about the proposed LGBTRC changes. But unfortunately, our meeting was scheduled for the day of the snow day. So that meeting is canceled and is rescheduled for this Friday. So I'm going to motion to table because we didn't actually get the opportunity to talk about it.
Second.
And the sense of tabling. Okay,
Point of information.
Yes.
How long are we tabling this for?
Can we just table it definitely? Because I don't know if we want to table it.
So, point of
information.
Yeah. Oh, until the next meeting. Table's
over
next meeting.
Tabling until the next meeting, there's been a second. Any dissent to tabling until the next meeting? Seeing none, this resolution is tabled until the next meeting. And last, on the old business, we have discussion on resolution 11. Rebecca?
So I
introduced this resolution last week, or last meeting. My statement that I made on the floor is also in this packet. We ended partially through discussion. It sounds like some of the things that we called for in this resolution have started to be discussed already. In the office and staff meeting, which unfortunately I was unable to attend on Friday, which essentially was the purpose of said resolution, but I think for formalities purposes and hoping that something still officially comes of it, it would be nice to either have discussion on completing it or go ahead.
So first of all, I said last time, I want to thank you so much for bringing this forward. I know I had supported it. I mean, we don't have a process. We had a problem. The correct answer is we had a process. So, and I met the applicant on Friday. I made a good discussion. I know we were looking at this, actually I had copies in front of me at the meeting. We were really trying to hit the high points, so I completely agree. I mean, I think we should discuss it if there's a desire to discuss it. But I really think we should set it an option. Like, I said, we're committed to that. I'm saying it's formally sent to you. You have it on your desk. Figure out this process and as a formal acting way of ensuring that the assembly's will is known to the committee. I mean, I think it is, but you mentioned formality. I think that's a good way to formally say, get this done, we're committed back to you.
So let's move on to a formal discussion on the resolution then. Any comments?
So one part is on the line 35 year resolve clause. It says, do not attempt to formally discipline or remove any member via any process that does not currently appear in a government document. One of the more complex things or interesting things about the GPSA in particular is that is sometimes what appears or does not appear in a document is strangely sometimes interpretable, and there we don't have anyone to interpret it. For 99% of the time, it's been not a problem because everyone's been in consensus about what happened. It's the 1% of the time that we don't have a consensus on what our documents are saying. And when we, it makes the last line tricky to interpret because we don't have this interpretable process. But in the future, when we go forward, is we're thinking about coming up with a clear process between the members that we should do. But we also need to think about who has the authority to interpret our documents.
Yeah.
And then we all have to kind of abide by that authority.
And which members need to be present when that discussion actually happens.
You discuss that exactly or not.
Yeah. So that's what I'm saying, is that I think even if we pass language as it is, I mean 35 to 37 is not gonna be any more clear than it is now, just because that's what it is, but that's part of what I would hope would come out of the discussion when operations and stuff committee has it, is that we come up with some sort of consensus about who has the authority to interpret our government documents.
I think that's really important, and I think that this is just as much a political statement as it is meaning that what you're saying, hoping that operations does address this, and I think if there's a way that we should clarify that, any further in the actual language?
Yeah, I think that's my point. Is it's kind of like a circular thing. Is that it's hard to make something clear to the person who decides who makes it clear is the same thing you're trying to decide.
Right.
So yeah. There's no good way to say it, and so you can leave it as it is. I think, but I think we're just kind of have to float forward until we can.
Yeah, no, that's,
I
appreciate that.
Matt? Oh, I said that we discussed it, instead of not.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sounds like we're all the same.
Any other comments? Motions?
Motion to send this resolution to
Jesse.
Withdrawn.
I'll call the question. Sorry, that's the
Is there a second? Is there dissent to voting on this resolution? Does it dissent?
I would articulate it at the beginning. I think this is opposite in the process. I think sending this to the president's desk is a little bit interesting considering that we're doing it ourselves. And I think sending it to ops would be the right way to do it. So ops can sit there and work its way through it. And hopefully, I mean, I imagine it's going to be done back to us at some point. But I think the president's desk is a little bit interesting. Not the right way to put this at this time.
Okay. So there's been a dissent to voting.
Can I ask a question in just a second? Is there a reason why you want it on the president's desk? Because you mentioned that it was a political thing. So is there a reason that you want it on the president's desk?
I think it's more having it here.
Oh, okay.
Like in writing.
But like, if you don't need it on the president's desk. Okay,
right. No, I think Matt is correct in sending it off.
Sorry, if we vote to pass this resolution, does it end up on the president?
Yes. Yes.
Exactly. Yes. Yes.
So we're not voting.
Well, we still have to vote on the
president. Yes.
Oh, unless I withdraw.
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to withdraw. That's something else that's a little longer than
you. Move to send the resolution not.
Okay, there's been a motion to send the resolution to
vote.
Okay, so
yeah.
Yes.
We are currently deciding whether or not to vote on the measure.
No, so let me clear that up. So Jesse made that motion, and he has withdrawn that motion.
Yes.
So currently, the motion, the active motion on the body is...
To commit this resolution to operations and staffing.
To commit this resolution to operations and staffing.
Great, thank you. Okay.
Point of information?
Yes.
Is this an indefinite? Is this committing indefinitely?
Oh, it's an indefinite committee until the committee can work on it.
Oh, to be indefinite.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes.
Can I amend the motion?
Sure. Are you amenable to taking a friendly amendment?
Yeah. So the amendment would be to commit it to ops, but definitely in expecting that, like, two meetings from now, we have a report back from them, and that we'll either consider the resolution further or anything that comes out of ops. So that way, it kind of tries to accomplish both.
I have to remember looking to have the ops for report within the next two meetings.
Okay, so the motion right now is commit the resolution to ops and expecting an update in two meetings from us. Okay. Eugene.
I just have a question. Is there ever any intent to send this resolution to the president?
I mean, I think if we're able to actually accomplish something out of office staffing that sets a new precedent of how we deal with these issues in the past, then no.
So perhaps would it be advisable to, instead of framing this as a resolution, framing this as simply a motion where the GPSA commits this task to ops? No, it's not, because by sending the resolution to ops, we would then need to bring the resolution back from ops to vote on it here. We don't want it to be a resolution because we don't want it to go to the president. We want to make a motion to have ops address the issue.
I agree with you being, that's why I mean it this way, is that basically what it does is that if ops doesn't do something, then this resolution comes back on the table, and then we're forced to address it again or to pass the resolution. If we just use a motion to commit to ops, definitely there's no consequence for if ops says, oops, we didn't get to it, sorry.
It's just holding ourselves accountable for things we said we're going to do.
Yeah, well, I would hope that we do that, but, you know, surprise, it doesn't happen. That's a general statement.
So now we have Matt.
I completely agree. The reason my command is ops is going to address the issue, and ops may, my mind, ops in places with a member of our language committee, and to fix this, you're going to have to have something change in our government documents, which will come back in the form of a resolution. So my committee to ops is to try to use a resolution, look at it, and then this can change it, modify it, or in this case, replace it with a fix. That's my understanding of what I'm trying to look for. If it's a semantical difference, if it's a semantic difference made a change, I'm more than happy to talk about that.
Seems great.
Point of information on what committing to, the committing to ops is essentially tabling the resolution and guaranteeing that we're going to untable it within 2 weeks with the changes made by ops.
Two meetings. Was that the intent of
the intent was send it to ops, and ops will handle this, and then within two meetings, ops will provide an update or language. I mean, assuming they're in the mid-process, I don't want to pull it from the mid-process.
Manisha.
Okay. Weep over it. Okay. So, I think that it still makes sense to send it to ops, because ops can change literally everything in this resolution and put all the new language into this resolution, and then we can vote on it and then change it as needed. And also, part of it is, if ops cannot reach a consensus, then we want this resolution back, because we're like, okay, at this point, we're children and we can't figure it out, send it to the president. Like, that's part of why it's not being made a motion and it's a resolution still and it's being tabled.
Okay.
my understanding of talking to you, listening to this and talking to you.
Holding us accountable to actually get this fixed.
Okay.
There's a motion in a second. Are we going to vote on a motion?
Yes. Okay, so can you restate the motion again?
I would be delighted to. This is a motion that will send this resolution to operating staffing for its consideration to address these points, which has already begun. Within 2 meetings, operating staffing provide an update on their progress, and assuming there is no progress, the resolution will come back.
Okay, is there's a second?
Second.
Okay. So let's vote on that motion. Those in favor of Matt's motion, please raise your flag. Those opposed, abstained. So with a vote of 10-0-6, the motion passes. This will be committed to ops, and we'll hear more about it in 2 meetings from now. Next on the agenda, we have open forum. Anyone would like to make any comments? Tyler.
So in the division breakout, it was brought up within the bio sciences that it would be useful if there was a document or a guide that could be sent out to field reps about what GPSA, how it works, how you work inside of it. So there is an archived document that I'm trying to get access to. If anyone has an interest in working on that with me and the other field representative, hit me up on Slack or talk to me.
Okay, Nate.
So I just want to remind everyone that the GDPI is still a thing for at least the rest of the year. Again, that's our 5-year strategic plan and needs assessment strategic plan that's expiring at the end of this year. I'm trying to get some people together that will look at it or at least consider it and adopt this revision and revampment. I know there's administrative support for continuing this, but they can't do it on their own. It needs to be a collaborative effort that's going to succeed. So if you're interested in that at all, or just, want to peek in on the conversation, my email is ngr27@cornell.edu, and I'll make sure to put you up with it.
Okay. Any other comments or announcements? Yes, next thing. That's everyone's favorite. Is there a second to adjourn? Okay, is there any dissent to adjourning now? Okay, seeing none, meeting is adjourned.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.